Welcome back to the DocSF podcast. I'm Professor Stefano Bini from the University of California, San Francisco, your host. In today's episode, we bring you DocSF Science, where Dr. Fabrizio Billi, Dr. Amel Demirchan, and I unpack several of the most compelling AI papers of 2025 and explore their impact on the orthopedic landscape. These studies are outstanding, and our discussion will make the findings accessible and relevant for clinicians, researchers, and innovators alike. Let's join Fabrizio on stage.
Now we have a very popular segment that we've done many, many years now with Professor Billi here from UCLA. He's one of our colleagues, one of our co-hosts for this event. Fabrizio is a biomedical engineer. He's a professor at UCLA. He's in the Department of Orthopedic Surgery. If you don't follow him on LinkedIn, I recommend that he does his really remarkable summaries every so often about the latest and greatest technologies that will impact orthopedics and does a great job contextualizing them. And so he's been keeping track of some of the latest research articles, and we're going to go ahead and discuss that.
First of all, we are going to go through four papers. One is on RAG, the other is on MFMs and digital twins and co-robots. Well, you already met the panelists here. I had this slide on for a couple past years, and you know, I keep track of how it's changing. You know, last year we were at 100 billion parameters. This year is 1 trillion more parameters. It's moving fast, you know, just for context. So let's start with the paper that many consider a turning point for clinical AI. Almanac. This is a paper that was published in 2024 and takes a language model out of the lab and puts them into the clinic. The idea is simple but powerful. Instead of asking an LLM to answer a question from memory, it retrieves evidence directly from medical sources and it generates an answer. Stefano, what's your take on this paper?
Yeah, I should go a little further. What makes this paper so interesting, they partner with the New England Journal of Medicine. Yeah. And Jason is here somewhere, who's the CEO of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. Pay attention. I think we should do this. For those of you who don't know, I actually work with Jason. I'm the associate editor for artificial intelligence for the journal. And I just thoroughly love this position. I get to see a lot of these papers. So what this paper did is it partnered with the New England Journal of Medicine to use their library of data to inform the large language model, basically. And having trained it on thousands of articles, super peer-reviewed, probably some of the best in the world in their space, they're able to then ask the large language model to seek the answers to questions from a number of complex questions in healthcare. And they came up with some remarkable results. I want to put a little context on this. I just reviewed another article for the journal where they used ChatGPT and they asked questions. And their conclusion was that AI is terrible. Only 30% of the questions are correct. 70% of the articles cited where it didn't exist. But the point that I made back to them is you can't say that AI didn't work. You can say that that particular model was not effective to answer the question at hand. So the take-home message we're going to get to here is that AI is not just this random thing. It's not one thing. Each model is trained on a specific data set. It is biased by that data, but within that data set, it's very accurate.
So, Emil, what's your take on this paper?
Yes, thank you. So my perspective would be from, you know, robotics. I was trained as a roboticist in computer science. And I can tell you in the community, we have a lot of discussion on how to integrate AI into different applications. And because more often we know how to solve a problem, what is challenging is to find the right problem to solve. And this is a good example, this paper, a good application in healthcare. But I believe for any application where you use AI to empower one, you know, application, you need more data and more validation, especially in this case, the clinical settings, right? And I think when I read the paper, I saw it has a great potential. It was validated by a panel of certified physicians and healthcare workers, but it's really still very subjective. So we need more data, and we need more various contexts, different applications where this can be applied. So, for example, future work can focus on, you know, developing automated metrics, right? Not subjective, but that align with human evaluation. So it has great potential, but there is a couple of flaws, especially in generating accurate responses in handling questions that lack straightforward answers and data sources. So integrating into healthcare setting should be approached with caution and it should be accompanied with strategies and a strong metrics to mitigate potential errors. So I see a great potential.
Yeah. Let's just review the results of that paper.
Yep. So if we go back here, this paper demonstrates how retrieval keeps LM current and trustworthy. So were you convinced that these increase AI trust?
Well, it had 92, 93% accuracy. It didn't come up with a single paper that didn't exist. I bet you that if the physicians had been asked not to check the answers, but to come up with the answers, they wouldn't have been as successful. This is a super solid model. In fact, one of the first things I did with our team is to look up how we can download the software. It turns out to be not so easy, but it is definitely, I thought it was impressive. And for sure, if I had access to this, I'd probably do it 10 times. And if it was right 10 times, I'd start trusting it.
Perfect. Let's move to the next one. So medicine is more than text. So what happens when we integrate images, notes, and signals? So this is the other paper, foundational models that unify images, text, and other clinical data. Once we move beyond text, the next step is integration. This paper, a multimodal foundational model, shows how AI can combine imaging, clinical notes, and structured data. The results are striking, right?
So let's just once again double down on what this actually means. So multimodality means that there are multiple data sources. So imaging, that's one modality. Within that, you got X-ray and MRI. They're different modalities. You could throw in text from a clinical chart. As you saw from Daniel Kraft's note, nowadays you can include voice or skin temperature. Anything coming off a sensor now becomes a new modality. If you think about it, up until recently, we've done unimodal training. We've taken a bunch of X-rays and showed it to a model and asked it to figure out something within that X-ray. But we as humans do more than that. We look at the X-ray, then we'll take a look at the MRI, and while we're at it, we'll take a look at the note and see if there's any history of that, and maybe look at our physical exam. That's multimodality, and there we're synthesizing that data to come up with an answer. What they're doing that now is they're replicating that with an artificial intelligence model that can take these multiple modalities and understand them. And in some ways, it harkens back to the physical AI discussion we just had.
Right. So this uses contrastive learning, reconstruction, multi-view consistency that they show outperforms unimodal approaches. And that's no wonder there, right? So we are moving towards that contextual intelligence that we were just discussing before. Emil, your take on this paper?
Of course, yeah. So there was a pivotal development in this domain, especially for imaging and, you know, perception, is the creation of realistic images and image data sets through three-dimensional Gaussian splatting. So this is a technique that involves training Gaussian models to represent surgical instruments and scenes separately. That would allow, you know, generation of high fidelity predict surgical scenarios. So this is very useful and instrumental, I think, in training and validating surgical robots, especially, you know, so that they can perform effectively in different clinical environments.
So next one, if we could move from data integration to a living simulation of the patient, right? So here we are, medical digital twins, hot topic these days, right? So digital twins take all of the patient data from imaging to genomics to wearables. Daniel Kraft showed us a glimpse of it. And then create a continuously updating virtual replica. What would you do with this replica, right? This Lancet paper lays out five-part framework: patient, data connection, in silico model, interface, and twin synchronization. Together, these elements allow clinicians to simulate scenarios and test outcomes. What would you do with a digital twin?
So I love the papers you picked this year, because one of the things that we do, I think, better than anyone at DocSF is bring to you ideas from outside your sphere of influence, your daily grind, and bring them to you so a way that you can see how they can be applied. Because so much is happening outside of orthopedics. If you stay in that little world, we'll miss the game. So digital twins have been around for a while. Every single engine up there on every single airplane has a twin that's running on a server that's tracking the sensor data coming off that engine. Because every plane goes through turbulence differently, each engine, each wing will have a different take on that power consumption, and therefore the time at which each individual blade needs to be changed differs. And that is why each of those engines is pulled off then to be maintained differently, different times. Imagine if we could do that with humans. We could track them as individual. We have a twin of the engine, of the person, and then we can see what stressors are happening to them. And because of those stressors, we can understand how we should treat them. And this is what this paper gets at, is do medical digital twins, how do we make that happen? One of the things I learned was actually driven, I kind of assumed that the medical digital twin of a human would be hard because we're so complicated. They said, yes, that's true, but you don't have to image the entire body. You can just do the kidney or the liver, in our case, the knee, whatever else you're really curious to track. A little bit the example you showed earlier. So I thought this is a great paper looking at how to do this and how it's going to happen. And we'll have a lecture about how that's happening real time today.
So ML, digital twins, what's your take?
I really like this paper. So many of existing computational models, they are being rebranded as digital twins. But in this paper, they integrate those five components you mentioned, which differentiates digital twins from conventional modeling approaches. So one particular example I saw in the paper is for wearable technologies, which often, you know, measure patients' vital signs and biometrics in real time. And unlike clinical tests, and you know more better than me, that are designed and optimized to denote the onset of the disease, wearables can enable detection of more subtle changes, and that can provide insights into, you know, individuals' wellness and early signs of if something goes wrong. And it can connect the patient to, I don't know, his family or medical doctor or personal trainer. So it offers means of direct communication with the patient. So it serves as an interface, right, to relay information from the model and clinical team to the patient, which is very powerful given the feedback loop of the medical digital twins.
Thank you. Okay, so what happens when AI moves from screen into the OR? And this is what this next paper is about, right? So we leave the screen, we enter the operating room. This paper describes a new approach to robotic surgery where the robot doesn't just execute commands, it collaborates. Obviously, it's using augmented reality, haptic feedback, eye tracking, and the system models the surgeon's attention and dynamically adjusts his level of autonomy. So what's your take?
Right, exactly. Like, it was actually quite interesting. What it takes a challenging problem, which is placing a screw in a pedicle in the spine, millimeters away from the spinal cord, millimeters away from nerves. And so it's one of the most challenging tasks, and we've seen various approaches to it. What this one does, it layers on top of it an AI, a co-pilot/agent, that actually starts to track surgeon attention to the problem. Should the surgeon pay less attention, the robot actually backs off and pulls power away from the drill. If the surgeon is fully integrated, it allows the process to go faster. It is really taking, and it's using eye tracking from the headset to understand what the surgeon is looking at and with what intensity. This combination of measuring the surgeon's data input, along with haptic feedback from what's actually happening in the bone, creates sort of a next generation approach to robotic surgery, where rather than simply limiting the AI piece to the planning part and perhaps creating the rails, as Doug just mentioned earlier, actually going along with us on that journey along that rail to make sure that things are happening correctly. Now, I'm not sure where Doug would see this go into an autonomous robot. This is a vision of robotics as a human in the loop concept.
Yeah, exactly. So this, by the way, was the result, the data here were validated. So
you mentioned that the validation was that the human by himself versus robot by itself.
Correct.
This was better than both.
Correct.
In terms of accuracy.
Exactly. Emo, cognitive robots. What's your take?
Yes, this is an amazing application. So now things are becoming more task-oriented. And this is the only paper I see equations, which is great. We want to see equations, and in this case, have to connect human cognition to robot task dynamics. But you also need interfaces, right? In addition to mathematical foundations, you need interfaces that connect human skills to the robotic platform. And haptics is an amazing tool, an interface that connects human intuition and skills to any synthetic robotic system. with high resolution and high safety. This is what is important for us as roboticists, right? High performance and high safety at the same time. But haptics also provides force feedback. So it closes a loop and provides real-time feedback to human operator, which is also a great component. So I was trained in, I'm a mechanical engineer, but I was trained in a computer science department at Stanford where we use those haptic devices for different applications. So if you have a chance, so now we have Stanford Robotics Center. If you have a chance to try those haptic devices, virtual surgical procedures, you'll see how intuitive those hardware systems are. So in this particular paper, in addition to haptics, there's also another dimension of augmented reality, which brings vision in addition to touch, right? So this also is an augmented multimodal system that provides the surgeon with multiple parameters in real time and also feedback, right? So there is also the model that developed that tracks human eye to understand if the surgeon gets fatigue or loses attention. So that would modulate the forces being applied to the robot according to the model. So it's a pretty robust system that integrates simulation and hardware for a meaningful application.
Thank you. Now, to broaden the discussion, what's real today and what's still aspirational? You know, from this paper, what's your take? What do you think? Where are
you? You know, I have a slide that I have which shows a wave coming on a beach and just wiping everything out and going away. And that's what everybody thinks technology is, that somehow it just comes in and overnight, it's all new. Well, I think a better visual is rain. On a rainy day, you'll see one drop, then it takes a while before another drop drops. But eventually two drops come together, fall a small pool, and eventually those pools could have, and eventually it's all covered. And that's what we're talking about with this question. Because the technology, I think this is what Daniel Kraft was pointing to, is like, it's here, guys. It's not yesterday, it's not tomorrow. A lot of this stuff is today, it's here. And the question is, how do we both implement it? But to those of you that enjoy math, it's like, how do you get one and one and get three? I just start saying, well, hi, that was a great idea. I hadn't thought about connecting that with this other thing I'm working on and now getting to something even better. And I think Doug, to some extent, with his robotic applications, he was forced to rethink how to do autonomous robotics. And in so doing, has connected a number of different technologies to develop what will be probably the latest cutting-edge autonomous robot. So this is really, to me, a question about, yes, it's all real. Some of it is coming. I'm not sure I know enough to say what's coming. But aspirationally, to me, is how are we going to put this together? And it won't be everywhere all at once. It'll be at institutions like UCSF that will lead the way, and others will follow. And that's just fine.
Emo, you are one of the world leaders in robotics and motion analysis. So, and we see these new wave of autonomous robots and now cognitive robots. So how is the landscape changing in robotics? What's your take on that?
In the society, we have a lot of discussion. Well, if you ask me that question 10 years ago, I had another a different answer. But today, with all the advances in hardware, in computation power, in AI, and in robotics, I don't think there's any problem we cannot solve. Again, the question is, what is the right problem to solve, right? And what is the roadmap? So what's going to be in 10 years from now? What is the vision? And it's going to be a collective vision, not only from engineers, but we need practitioners to come into the discussion. And we need more conferences like this, to bringing together scientists, researchers, and practitioners to find the right problems. So AI has great potential, especially for surgical robotics, for wearable applications, and for clinical settings, right? So in terms of hardware, again, things are getting less and less expensive, which is good. So we have more access. So different platforms, different robotic platforms, it's open, the data sets are available. Many of them are available online. So there's a great collaboration between different labs across the world. That's the good direction. But we need more discussions. So when I read the first two papers, I had an idea that was, so for example, if you're an engineer who creates some predictive simulations and you want a medical doctor to look at the graph, right? The results that you have. But as engineers and physical therapists and orthopedic surgeons, they all have different vocabulary, different language. So what if we had an automated AI system that takes those graphs from engineers and transform into a more intuitive model that an orthopedist can, you know, make more informed decisions using that? So there's a lot of potential, great potential, which I think comes with great challenges.
Thank you. Stefano, so access to data is not an issue most of the time, but patient data access is still an issue. And so I was kind of struck by what Unity said before, which tools that are used in smartwatches and are becoming more sophisticated than what we use in clinics. So how do you see the future moving to solve that issue?
So accessing patient data is what you're getting at, and using it to train models and therefore having better models. So that's a very complicated question. So where does the data reside? Some of it resides on people's phones, which are linked to their watches, and they can choose to share it. And that is up to them. They can do that. There's actually people who put up data banks that you can actually upload your data and you can be paid in Bitcoin if you share it with certain companies. That's been done. People are looking at it. There is data that resides within the frameworks of insurance companies, of healthcare systems. It's very valuable. It's so valuable it's being hacked with a cybersecurity issue. The way that the current limitations are on data utilization make it superbly difficult to share that data. Any data that goes even under IRB has to go into high trust servers. High trust servers cost about $1 million, we've learned recently, to build. Insurance companies aren't necessarily going to share it. But here's where I think there's an opportunity. And we talked about this at DocSF, I think it was last year, 2 years ago, is there's two interesting things that happen. One is federated data learning and federated data sharing. And the other one is synthetic data. So synthetic data is ability to take a corpus of data, which is 100 patients, 1,000 patients, whatever it is, and look at patterns in that data and create new patients that are not duplicates of existing data, of existing patients, but that act mathematically as if they were a brand new patient. And you can enlarge a data set from 1,000 to 10,000 very quickly. And you can even within that adjust for variations in, like, if there's not enough females, but you have the females you have, you increase them so you have a more appropriate data set. And the other is federated data learning sharing, where data actually stays within its own server. It can even remain encrypted, and yet it can be accessed. And the visual for that is, instead of taking the data to the software, you take the software to the data. And Mayo Clinic's building a huge medical data set that way, and we're looking to be able to do that. I think that will be one answer to the data question.
Right. So, Emo, last year we had a fantastic talk here at DocSF. What came out was that once a robot learns, all the robots in the world learns. Is that true? And do you see any barrier into that future?
Yes. So I think scalability is a major issue. Like humans, every individual is different, right? So we have different muscle capacity, different range of motion. Scaling is also an issue in robotics, especially for different platforms and for different designs. It all depends on the task itself. So we have a robot is an embodiment, right? So it's an embodiment that connects, or that should connect, human brain to perform a specific task. So you can make a robot fully autonomous, but what is more interesting is to keep human in the loop and adjust the robot dynamics and control based on human feedback. Of course, we need to keep human trust, right? So we don't want human to be disconnected from the artificial system. So my answer to that question is we don't have the solution yet for having one robot learn something and now all the robots know how to do it, because the systems are very complex. The capabilities depend on the task. So each robot is designed to perform a task. And if you integrate AI, so this should take into account the physical capabilities of the robot itself, which is great. So we should have different robots. We shouldn't have one robot learn and all the other robots can do the same thing, because we designed the robots to do different things, right? So yeah, those are my takes for that particular question. And that's a great question, but we still have no solution for it, no answer for it.
Thank you. Look at that.
Amazing.
Thank you so much, Emil. Thank you, Stefano. and I hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I truly enjoyed this conversation. Reviewing these papers was both humbling and inspiring. Next week, we'll shift gears with Greg Greiner, a partner at ORIC, and two physician-turned-investors, as they discuss the financial climate for orthopedic innovation. You won't want to miss it.